And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the... It's kind of a wintry day today. It's not the worst day of the winter, even this mild winter. It's not frigid, but it's gray for the most part. Sun's popped out a couple of times. We've had flurries. We've had some squalls. Temperatures are hanging right around the 30-degree mark. Wind a little bit. Yeah, it's going to be slightly colder tomorrow, but in case you haven't heard the long-range forecast... Get out the hibachi again for the weekend. They're talking about temperatures in the mid-50s again, this coming weekend. But today we kind of bundle up a little bit, gather around the radio. We have some good conversation for you on the program today. I'll tell you about our first guest and our first subject in just a moment. But I do want to mention for, I guess, past week or so now, I've been telling you that we're going to be chatting about what many people think is the biggest mystery of Pittsburgh. What happened to the World War II-era bomber that crashed into the Mon River? And it was 61 years ago, and it was almost exactly this time of year. It was actually the last day of January that it happened. We will not be talking with someone who witnessed it, but as close as you can. We were able to hook up through a mutual friend with Paul Zwitek, who lives up in the Parker area. And he, at one time earlier in his life, worked on tugs on the Mon. And he talked with people who were not only there, he talked with one man who actually saw the plane crash into the Mon near the, what at that time was called the Homestead High Level Bridge. It's now the Homestead Grays Bridge. So that's pretty good stuff. Now, if you're not familiar with this, this is the subject of vast conspiracy theories, and we'll certainly explore some of them today. We don't even pretend to have, the answer. It's just such a mystery. I mean, a Piper Cub goes down or one of those small experimental aircraft. Okay, unusual, but I guess it could disappear. A bomber, a B-25, disappears into the Mon. And not very deep at that point either. So we'll be talking about that later on the program today. Our first guest is a friend of long standing. Rodney Gash is here. He's the president of Historic Harmony. And we'll talk a little bit about Harmony Museum, but we want to get all the details, first of all, on the upcoming George Washington's hike. Rodney, good to see you. Nice to have you back with us today.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
I was just chatting with Rodney, folks, and before we went on the air here, while we were sitting in the studio, and I mentioned, and I mean it, I've talked with Rodney several times on the air. It's always enjoyable. Always enjoyable. First of all, we have two people of kindred spirits here who love local history. And sometimes we can get going and pretty hard to get us stopped. Well, speaking of local history, that's the real subject of the upcoming George Washington's hike. And it's just around the corner, isn't it, Rodney?
Absolutely. It's a week from Saturday, February 25th, and it's at the Jennings Educational Environmental Center up between kind of the intersection of Route 8 and Route 528 between Butler and Slippery Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have French and Indian War reenactors. This is one of the big attractions because these people study what life was like during that time frame. We're looking at 1753 is when Washington traveled through here, just literally months before the outbreak of the French and Indian War. In fact, Washington's visit to Butler County was pivotal in the outbreak of the French and Indian War. And you get the chance to witness a musket shot that could well have felled Washington as just a 21-year-old lad as he was tromping through the wilderness here.
So the reenactors will have some period weaponry with them?
Absolutely. They'll have recreations of the black powder musket, and then they'll have on display so you can touch and talk to them their outfits that woodsmen and frontiersmen would have worn at those days, as well as flint and flintlock rifles and knives. I hope the one fellow can come who has a whole thing about money, which is very interesting, all the different little bits about money. If I may digress, there's a neat talks about why, if you look at on a quarter, it has little edges on. Well, that's because in the old days, back in that time, the coins were made of gold, and if you could shave off the edge, you could shave a little bit of gold and then sell that gold and still make the coin pass as a full value. By putting those edges like we see around our quarter, that was where that tradition came from, and apparently that's the origin of the name chiseler. That if you shaved off the side of the coin, you were chiseling the coin and trying to reduce its value to your benefit.
Never heard that story. We're talking more than 250 years ago. I guess we just shaved a little bit. It would still work in the Coke machine.
Yeah, right.
That's a fascinating story. I've wondered about that, why there are notches around the edge of most of our coins. I think the nickel is the only one that doesn't have any. Yeah. Well, anyway, another story for another day. But that's the kind of local history tidbits, American history tidbits, that I just love. The date for the hike this year is when?
Saturday, February 25th. And there are actually 10 hikes in total. So if you really want to get a good workout, there's a 7-mile hike that actually starts in Moraine State Park and will end at Jennings. Mm-hmm. That's led by members of the North Country Trail Association. And then there'll be a shuttle to take you back, unless you're energetic enough to walk the 7 miles back. You can do that as well. And then there are two other types of hikes. There's three nature walks that the Jennings Environmental Education Center park staff leads. And then there's six history hikes. And this is where you'll learn about Washington's mission in 1753 and why he was in western Pennsylvania, and that's the history hike is where you will see the reenactment of the shooting and hear the musket shot ring through the woods that Saturday.
Is there 25th. A charge if you want to participate in any of these hikes?
Yes, there's we're asking for a $2 donation, and with that you get the guided hike, you get a piece of cherry pie and coffee or apple cider, and we've got great people supporting us. The pie is provided by the Harmony Museum, as well as North Country Brewing and Slippery Rock. And the Butler County Tourism Department is providing the apple cider and cookies, which is great. The whole event is sponsored by the Washington's Trail 1753. That's an organization that put up those blue and white signs that you see, the profile of Washington on some of the highways here, as well as the Butler chapter of the North Country Trail Association, Harmony Museum, and of course the park is an integral part of this, the Jennings Environmental Education Center.
I've talked in the past with retired President Judge Martin J. O'Brien about that. He was one of the individuals who spearheaded that Washington's Trail Association, getting those, first of all, laying out the path that George Washington almost certainly took, and then putting those signs up. And by the way, folks, this was scientific research. They weren't guessing. I mean, we knew that George Washington, then very young, by the way, he was only in his 20s.
Yeah, 21.
Had come up from Virginia, and that he hiked generally from Pittsburgh up to Fort LaBeouf, I think.
Where Waterford, Pennsylvania is.
Yeah, where it is now. So it's not all the way to Erie, but close. We knew that he did that. That's part of history. We also know almost exactly where he went on that lengthy walk, because he kept a journal. And not only did George Washington keep a journal and write down every night when they camped, where they'd been, what they saw, but his guide, Christopher Gist, also kept a journal. So, I mean, these are scientifically plotted points, the so-called Washington's Trail through Butler County.
Well, and then sometimes I've heard people say, oh, gee, it looks like Washington went up Route 19 and back down Route 8 and 528. And as a matter of fact, he probably, that's what he did do, because those were originally Indian trails. They were Indian trails widened to pioneer trails and wagons, and eventually they got paved over and became Pennsylvania roads. So that's he literally would have taken the path, because those were time-honored trails that the Indians took.
There's a by the way, Native American Indians, if they were going from this area to Katanning, way back when, 200, 300 years ago, they generally followed the route that 422 is right now. That was the Indian path from Kittanning to Butler. I discovered there's a wonderful story and maps of these trails in a book. It's an old book, The Planting of Civilization in Western Pennsylvania, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. And I'm not kidding you. I mean, I'm on my second copy. The first one, I would refer to it so much and read it so much, it's a paperback book and the binding shot, so I had to get another one. Great book if you're interested in local history, Indian maps and all that kind of stuff. Really, really good.
Another book that's back in print, I know the Harmony Museum shop has this book. It's by Paul Wallace. It's called Indian Paths of Pennsylvania, and that too spells out, has all these maps and where these trails would have been. And Paul was part of the Pennsylvania History Department, so it's very fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I don't own that book, but I've read it. I've seen it. And by the way, speaking of the journals, there was an effort by a grad student at Slippery Rock, Copper. Oh, what was this? Was it Kevin?
Kevin, I think, yes.
Yeah, Kevin Copper, I think. I get confused because his father was a professor at Slippery Rock, too. But Kevin, I don't know whether it was for one of his graduate or doctorate projects, I'm not sure, he took the two journals of George Washington and Christopher Gist, which still exist, and he merged them into one book, so you can read it and get the differing picture from both of these guys. Isn't it amazing that they both, at the end of a long day, would sit down by the campfire and put an entry into their journal?
Yes, very fascinating. And it's also interesting to see they saw the perspectives of what happened slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, when Washington made it back to Virginia to report on his trip, the governor of Virginia encouraged him to write up and publish his diary, his journal, in an effort to sort of gin up the war effort, to like, we need to rally the people to kick the French out of the land that's claimed by Great Britain. And so Washington re-edited his journal a little bit, and it's interesting, there's some places where Washington's take makes him look a little more heroic. So
I didn't know that story. That's fascinating.
Well, there's one part, and it's not major differences, but there's one part where Washington is concerned because it's December when he's traveling through here. It's very cold. The horses are real slow. There's a lot of snow. They can't find anything for the horses to eat. And Washington tries to get Gist to abandon the horses. So Washington's version is, I impressed on Gist the importance that we make faster time, and he agreed to abandon the horses. Gist's version, you can see he's a little worried about this 21-year-old kid from Virginia. He said, Washington wants to abandon the horses. I'm not sure it's a good idea if this guy's ever really done this, knows how strenuous it's going to be, but he's insisting, so the horses are going, and we're going to make off the best we can. So
I want to pick up that story because I'm learning a little bit here. I love it. I do want to make sure people know the $2 donation. I mean, goodness gracious, yeah. You get your coffee, you get your pie, you get a guided hike. I mean, my goodness. But you must make a reservation, right, to ensure that you get a spot in one of these six hikes.
Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, though. So you want to go to the State Park website, and which is actually events.dcnr.pa.gov. And if you search, and that'll get you to all the events at all the state parks. So we need to narrow it down. So in the search box, if you put in cherry pie, that'll zip you right to the Jennings spot. And then just scroll through all the different hikes. Like I said, there's the one long hike, three nature hikes, six history hikes, and then reserve your spot. We're trying to make it so it's relatively small group. 25, 30 people, so every hiker has a good experience. It's not like a big mob trying to get
through.
You
want to be able to hear the guide who's speaking, and you'll be stopping and he'll be showing you things and so on and so forth. So it's just like going through a museum. If you have a mob of people, you can't hear, you don't get it. So again, the date is a week from this Saturday. Not this coming Saturday, but the following one, which is the 25th. The deadline to make a reservation is February 23rd, which is next week. I guess that'd be Thursday next week.
Yeah.
So we'll give you that. web address again before we wrap up with Rodney, so don't worry if you missed it.
And I should say, if you don't want to hike, that you can come and talk to the reenactors. There's an author, Jason Cherry, is going to be there. You can pick up information about the North Country Trail. So the Harmony Museum shop will have some Washington related. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not up for a walk in the woods, you're welcome to come and
this
learn.
Will be at Jennings.
This is all at the Jennings. They have a large room there at mm-hmm. the Environmental Education Center.
Yeah, if you're familiar with Jennings, if you've been there, I love Jennings, by the way. I've been to Jennings. Sometimes I go to Jennings early in the morning in the dead of winter. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds crazy. So gorgeous. It's peaceful. You can hear the birds. And it's nice. And, of course, any time during the summer. If you're pulling into Jennings, you're going up Route 8, make a left turn there. There's actually the road, 528, goes right through the middle of Jennings. So on the left-hand side is where the Environmental Center is, the building, and so on and so forth. On the other side, there's parking over there, but that's to go to the prairie. Mm-hmm. If you want to visit the Relic Prairie. Okay, just wanted to make sure people know where they were going. Up at Jennings, it's right across the road from the Stone House. Can't miss it. I've never been there before. You want to make a reservation to make sure you secure a hiking spot. And again, we'll give you that website again before we wrap up. So some people might, if you don't know the story, you might be wondering what the governor of Virginia was doing sending George Washington into Pennsylvania. I mean, this is Pennsylvania now. It wasn't back then.
Right.
This was disputed territory. The William Penn people said, what are you talking about? Our charter from King, was it George? I don't remember. It was George III, I'm sure. Our charter goes from, what we now know as the Mason-Dixon line. It wasn't then. It goes from there to India, just keep that straight line going. And Virginia said, no. Virginia at that time claimed there was no West Virginia. That was still just Virginia. And Virginia wanted Western Pennsylvania, rich territory, fur trading, all that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, if that wasn't enough of a controversy, the French, who were in Canada, remember all those great French explorers who came? Some of them were missionaries. Some were Jacques Cartier and several of the other ones. They claimed Western Pennsylvania as well. So not only did they didn't think it was either Pennsylvania or Virginia, they didn't think it was England. They thought it was France. And France had built a series of forts down from Erie the whole way to Pittsburgh. And that's why Washington, you mentioned that this was really the start of the war. That's why Washington came up. His message was to tell the French to, hey, this is English territory. Get out of these forts here. Abandon these forts. The French, of course, politely said, no. Stick it up your nostril, George. We're not leaving. And that ignited the war.
And their whole plan, they were in French Canada. It wouldn't have been Canada, but they had Eastern Canada, a lot of the Great Lakes, and they were in New Orleans. So their thought, if we could control really just this little stretch that isn't connected by rivers from Erie down to the forks of the Ohio, we would control all the river, the whole Ohio River Valley and the Mississippi mm-hmm. Valley, and England would be stuck with this little strip of colonies along the Atlantic coast, and
they would have the mass.
So you can see the strategic, looking at a map, if they controlled that area, and this is really George kind of interrupted them from mm-hmm. doing that, mm-hmm. then they would have had a lock hold on the central part of the country.
I was reading an English history book a year or so ago. And it was this period, and they referred to the war between England and France as the Seven Years' War. And I remembered, oh, yeah, that's right. The only place where it's called the French and Indian War is here in the United States, in America. Everywhere else in the world, it's referred to as the Seven Years' War. And a lot of historians, Rodney, feel that that was really the First World War, because they had these two superpowers, England and France. They both wanted to control North America. They knew how rich it was. And they went at it, and other countries in Europe had to pick their sides, and lasted for 7 years.
Yeah, right, and there was conflict all over, not mm-hmm. not just in North America.
Yeah. By the way, the English won, in case you didn't know.
Or else we'd be speaking French, perhaps, on this radio
program.
Right.
At the forks of the Ohio, Fort Duquesne, which the French had already built. French name, obviously, Duquesne, became Fort Pitt as the English took it over. And they renamed all those other forts, too, up up the river, on up toward here. Now, France still maintained the territory that we later bought from France, the Louisiana Purchase, which came about 50 years later, early 1800s. Jefferson was president then. He's the guy that bought it for a song. But the English got western Pennsylvania, and the English also ended up with Canada, which is, you know,
somewhat ironic.
Yes, kind of a pretty big deal whenever the French lost all of that. And, you know, some of that enmity still continues. Is it the people of Quebec who every once in a while stir up and say, we want to become an independent nation because we all speak French, all our towns and cities are French names, what are we doing as part of the English Commonwealth here? You know, this is stupid. So that's part of the remnants of this war, too. It was a really big deal. And most of the battles, the majority of the battles fought in North America were right here in western Pennsylvania.
Right, yeah, that's very fascinating.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. So what was George doing up here? Well, the English, the governor of Virginia, what was the guy's name? I can't remember.
Dinwiddie,
thank you. He sent George up here to, it was a messenger, really. He sent a message. I was intrigued by because I'd never heard that story about Washington rewriting his journal for publication. I have read that one of the reasons that he was willing to take this mission, he was 21 years old, he was trying to get a commission in the British Army.
And I've read that was the ticket to being, to moving up in society. I mean, by comparison to the average person living in a log cabin, Washington looked pretty wealthy, but compared to the Washington's family, I should say, he was a young man. He was a planter and a surveyor. But then compared to the English royalty, you know, he was definitely lower classes. So the way to move up was to get a commission in the British Army. It didn't work out exactly. That's what he hoped for. He ended up being commissioned in the Virginia Militia, which was a disappointment to Washington. But was still, he's 21, and suddenly he's a major. That's not a bad deal, but it's not exactly what he hoped for.
And isn't it ironic that he would, within not too long a period, we're talking in the 1750s here, 20 years later, he was the supreme commander of the American Army, fighting the British.
Absolutely.
When he came to Butler County, he did it so he could get a commission in the British Army. Really ironic. Yeah.
And I should say, you know, we talked about the French not, you know, wanting to, you know, George kind of, Washington coming up to tell the French to be booted out. The shot we talked about, the reenactment of the shot, that is presumed that the French sent this Indian to say, if you can take out Washington and his guide, and they don't show up back in Virginia, it'll take another 2 years before Dinwiddie sends anybody else, and by then we'll have all our forts built and we'll be all armed up, and they won't be so easy to kick us out. So,
wow, I never heard that. I got to read more. I got to go on the hike coming up a week from Saturday, get some more. I thought I knew quite a bit about this. I'm learning a lot more today. So that makes sense. By the way, this shot Christopher Gist was Washington's primary guide, but they had a Native American Indian guide too, right?
Well, he wasn't really a guide. Remember I said about abandoning the horses? Washington and Gist are heading back to Virginia, and they're in a hurry. And they come into this town called Murdering Town or Murthering Town. Has a couple different names depending on how you read the writing in the journals.
Old English.
Yeah, journals. And no one knows exactly where this is. It gets to be amongst historians a heated discussion of where exactly that was, but someplace in Butler County. And the Indian pretends to know Gist and calls him by his Indian name and says, "So good to see you again." Gist doesn't recognize the guy. But he said, "Well, you know, where are you going, two guys?" And Gist said, "We're looking for a quick way to the forks of the Ohio," and the Indian said, "I'll lead you there." And about 10 miles later, Gist is checking his compass, and he goes, "This guy ain't leading us south. We're heading too much to the east." And then at some point, Washington and Gist are like, "You know, we're going to camp. I'm not sure we trust this guy." And at that point, it says he comes into a clearing. Snow had fallen. And so even though it's dusk, it's light. And the Indian turns and fires. Boom. And the Washington says to Gist, "Are you shot?" And Gist says, "No." And then they pounce on the Indian before he can reload, and Gist is ready to kill the Indian, but Washington, not wanting to cause disturbance with the local tribes, they decide just to take his gun and let him go, and then they head off down towards what's now Wexford, and it says they set their compass and headed south and to get away from the Indian as far and fast as they could.
And they eventually got to the forks of the Ohio, now Pittsburgh, and they remember now this is the dead of winter. This is January, January of 1753.
Yeah, December 27th is when the shot happened. And so.
And there's a Pennsylvania Historical Society marker along Route 68 between Butler and Evans City, noting that that occurred probably somewhere right in that area.
That's correct. Yeah.
Not sure exactly where, but somewhere in that area.
Yeah.
So Washington and Gist, of course, had to cross the Allegheny, partially frozen, in late December. And where do you think it was along the Allegheny? What we now know is Washington's Crossing. that's the 51st Street Bridge. Is that the one it is? It's the big. I get the numbers.
I should know the number. Yeah,
they all have different names now. But it's the Washington Crossing Bridge. That's why it's called that.
Yeah.
It goes right into Lawrenceville near Children's Hospital. Mm. That's where Washington and Gist crossed on rafts. And Washington almost died there, too.
That is an interesting story, too, because they get to it's been cold. They get to the Allegheny River. They think it's going to be frozen. And here there's just a mass of water and ice chunks. If you've ever been to Pittsburgh in a cold day, sometimes you see that, just a torrent of water and chunks of ice. And so they decide the only way to get across is to build a raft, which in Washington's journal, he said, "We set about doing with one poor hatchet." And they spent all day chopping up logs. I don't know how they strapped them together. And this is also a thing where you get a little slightly different version in the journals. Washington says he's poling across the river and a large chunk of ice hit his pole and flung him into the river, and he was able to swim to the, just luckily got to the raft and pulled himself on. Gist's version says Washington, having fallen off the raft and I'm cold, we went on an island and built a fire. So Washington's version sounds slightly more heroic, and I guess if I was 21 and writing up my journal, I probably would have done the same thing.
So this sounds like a novel, like a story that we're telling here. We're a couple of storytellers around the campfire. It's all true. How nice to be able to participate in this. Here's some of the history walk, and there are different lengths of hikes here, so if you're not an experienced hiker, you can still take one of the short ones, right?
Yep, the history hike is just 30 minutes, and the nature walk is like 45 minutes, and that'll you'll learn a little more fauna and flora about what's there in Jennings in winter.
And there are how many hikes altogether now?
10 altogether.
10?
Yep.
You have to register by the 23rd. The hikes all take place a week from Saturday the 25th. But the groups are limited in size, so you have to make a reservation, and you can do that online at the State Park website, which we will give you again before we wrap up. I've read about this. I've read the journals. It's still fascinating to me to think of George Washington as a very, very young man traipsing through Butler County, telling the French to get out of Dodge.
Yeah, especially when you think, he's the age of a typical Slippery Rock student.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Listen, I want to talk a little bit about Historic Harmony Museum. Rodney Gash is the new president of Historic Harmony. That's the nonprofit group that operates the museum, and it's only appropriate that we mention the service of the man that he replaced, who passed away quite suddenly late last year, John Rusch. Decades of service to Historic Harmony.
Absolutely, a total of 27 years he was president of the group, and during that time he really shepherded the development of the National Historic District, the preservation of buildings, the addition of, we have three log cabins that were deteriorating and were moved into harmony to one point, when the harmonists first came, the whole town would have been log cabins. Mm-hmm. And some of these still exist, houses that had been sided over when they were remodeled, discovered to the owner's surprise that they were log cabins. And so the whole preservation effort, John had a big role in that, and it's a really an important fixture in the community, and it's great. We have really great cooperation between the borough council, the Harmony Museum, and that's what really makes Harmony, big part of what makes Harmony such a charming town, the mm-hmm. preservation of these buildings, and then the fact that the museum is there to tell the history story.
And it's history of America too, not just local history. I can remember when I was in high school reading about the effort to establish utopian societies in certain mm-hmm. parts of the country and in the world, and that's what the Harmonists were trying to do. They were separatists. They were a little bit out on the fringe in terms of their religious beliefs. I'd never denigrate anyone's religious beliefs, but they were certainly way out of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. But they came here from Europe and founded Harmony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when they moved on farther west for looking for more opportunity, and they moved to New Harmony, Indiana, and then German Mennonites from eastern Pennsylvania came and bought the town of Harmony and the farmlands and built up that community. And the Harmony Museum also owns the Mennonite Meeting House, which was built in 1825, and back in October, right before John passed away, it was great that he got to see that was one of his last accomplishments. That's now listed on the National Register of mm-hmm. Historic Places, so that'll be preserved, and it's another fitting part of the history story we tell.
Harmony Museum, we speak of it as an entity. I mean, it is, but it's several different buildings and locations. Mm-hmm. It's a complex. It's open to the public, right?
Yeah, open to the public most afternoons, and you can get a guided tour and learn about local history. And one thing that we have coming up, March 11th, is our annual dinner meeting. We've got an innovative group of students from the University of Pittsburgh, music students, that are going to play some old-time 19th century music, that some of which the Harmonists may have played. And at that event, we're going to announce a major music festival that's coming to Harmony in at the end of July. And so I'll get a chance to come back on the show in summer, and we'll talk about old-timey music and what kind of fun things are happening in Harmony in July.
It's guaranteed. So tickets soon be available for
dinner? Yeah, people can call into the Harmony Museum now, and that's 724-452-7341. Or if you just do a website for Harmony Museum, you find the contacts. Mm-hmm. And we're just starting to get the press releases and buzz out and on that event, which is Saturday, March 11th. And that's mm-hmm. that's a dinner and musical entertainment, and it'll be a fun night.
It's a nice program, yeah. So that's about a month away, but just to, if you're interested in local history, if you want to support this incredible Historic Harmony group in their efforts to preserve local history, it's a nice night. It's a really nice night. We want to give the web address again for people who would be interested in making a reservation mm-hmm. for any of the 10 hikes mm-hmm. on the 25th.
That's right. And so the best thing is to go to the State Park website, and you'll find the best way to get there is events.dcnr.pa.gov, and that'll get you to all the events at all the Pennsylvania parks. So you want to get narrowed down to the Jennings, and that if you do put Cherry Pie in the search box in the upper right-hand corner, that should get you right to where those hikes are, and scroll through and find the time and the length that you want, and then you can register online. And the donation is actually taken at the event, so you don't pay any money over the internet.
Yeah, and it's big bucks, folks. $2 $2 donation, and you get pie for that. Yeah. You get the hot coffee. You get the guided tour, the local history. You get everything.
So, yeah.
Goodness gracious, that's a pretty good deal. And it's fun too. It's fun, and it's nice to have it at the. At this time of year, it's a little bit later than Washington would have passed through. It was in late December, but it's also very close to his birthday.
That's right, and that's part of the reason the cherry pie. We've been doing the Washington Trail hike and the Washington Trails Group, and the North Country Butler Chapter of the North Country Trail Association has been doing the cherry pie hike for about as long to celebrate Washington's birthday and have a good excuse to go out and hike in the winter. And we've combined these two events so you can get a long hike in the woods or a shorter hike and learn about history and nature.
Mm-hmm. So keep in mind, or maybe you know somebody, if you don't hike, if you've had knee replacement or whatever, you don't hike anymore, if you have somebody in your family or a circle of friends or your church group or whatever, this is really a great thing. Saturday, February 25th, week from this Saturday. It still boggles my mind to think that George Washington was here 20 years before he became commander of the colonial forces in what we refer to as a Revolutionary War, the War of Independence, I guess, would be the best thing. And you have to wonder if even he thought that this ragtag bunch of militia guys could defeat the army of the British Empire.
Absolutely. And, you know, he had enough trouble defeating the French, not him, but the whole British army. If you've been to Fort Necessity in southern Pennsylvania, that was a disaster for Washington and the British forces. But it's interesting, those lessons that he learned during the French and Indian War really served him well as he was on the other side fighting the British during the Revolutionary War.
And another great irony, Washington fought the French. And by the way, French and Indian War is definitely a misnomer, if you don't remember that from your history class. Because it sounds like it's the French versus the Indians. It was actually the French and the Indians was one team, and the English, well, that was the other team. So, you would think it more likely to be called the French and English War. Mm-hmm. But it's the French and Indian against the English, because the Native American Indians sided with the French. And yet, 20-some years later, well, it would be the end of the War of Independence, things switch around again. Mm-hmm. Here come the French sailing into Yorktown Harbor, and that was really what made Cornwallis throw in the towel. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, okay, we got Washington's army on one side, we got the French fleet out there in the harbor. We're done. We're out of here. You know?
The only consistency is the French still didn't like the English. They didn't like him in 1753, and they didn't like him in 1780 either.
True. And then, of course, the French would, I don't want to say copy our revolution, but they certainly used it as a guide, because it wouldn't be too much further down the road, a couple of decades from our revolution, when the French would have the French Revolution. I love talking about history, Rodney. I love to talk with you. Nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
And we will look forward to, when you get all the details wrapped up, this summer on your big, you'll be making the announcement at the dinner.
Yeah.
Let us know and we'll have you back on and talk
That'll
about it.
That'll be great. Mm-hmm.
More to come on It's Your Turn. Rodney Gash, the president of Historic Harmony, visiting with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking about one of the biggest mysteries in Pittsburgh. Some people think it's the biggest mystery of all. What in the name of heaven happened to the World War II era bomber that crashed into the Maumee River, crash landed? It was a Sully Sullenberger before Sullenberger, because the pilot ran out of gas and decided to make a quick decision. He said, I'm putting her down in the Maumee. I'm putting her down in the Maumee. But the plane disappeared. We'll talk about that, give you a little bit of that history, and also talk with a gentleman who will be our guest, Paul Switek. Paul didn't witness it. Paul's a Vietnam veteran, by the way, also a veteran of Desert Storm, so a lot of military service. But he once worked on tugs on the Maumee. And he talked with people who were there. He wasn't there himself. This happened 61 years ago. He talked with one of the pilots on the tugboat who saw the plane come down. So I want to talk to Paul. He'll be with us next after a few minutes break here. We'll be back with the next segment of It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there starts here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do.
Hop the bus.
Leave the driver. driving up to us. We're going your way.
Butler Memory Moments brought to you by St. Barnabas. Pullman Park has been home to a variety of sports organizations throughout its history, including Negro League teams, midget football, Butler High School football and baseball, and the Prospect League's Butler Blue Sox. In the late 1930s, Pullman Park was home to the New York Yankees farm team. And once when the Yankees major league team was traveling by rail between games, they stopped in Butler to spend the night at the Willard Hotel. Since their farm team was located here, the Yankees decided to play an exhibition game at Pullman Park. The game had to be called early because so many eager kids stormed the field, wanting autographs from their favorite players like Joe DiMaggio and Lou Gehrig. Among those kids was farm team bat boy Ed Vargo. Eddie went on to become an umpire in the major leagues, where he officiated several historic games. While many sporting events have happened at Pullman Park, the day the Yankees stopped was truly one to remember. This has been a Butler Memory Moment, brought to you by St. Barnabas.
Family vacations, trips to the ballpark, fishing at Raccoon Creek. Dad has always been by your side, making memories and taking care of the family. Today, Dad needs some help with daily care, and it's getting harder for him to live alone. St. Barnabas is here for your family. From on-site recreation to community outings, rest assured that your father will continue making memories in a safe, caring environment. To schedule a tour, call 724-443-0700.
One of our sponsors on the program today, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Boy, these folks do such good work. My. Such good work. They operate the thrift store, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8, just south of Butler. They operate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul food bank. They serve more than 2,500 people every month after month. And they also have their client aid program. And over the years, they've distributed about $1 million to people, to families, to individuals who need maybe help with a medical bill, a doctor bill, a gas or electric bill at the end of the month, especially in the winter. It's client aid, they call it. So how do they fund the food bank and client aid? Through the proceeds of the operation of the thrift store. So please, if you have any items that you're going to be throwing away, if you're cleaning out a closet, the garage, maybe spring cleaning coming up, consider donating. You know, put this stuff in a landfill anyway, right? Consider donating to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Clothing, furniture. If you have a lot of stuff or big stuff like furniture, they'll come and get it with their truck. So think about it. You'll feel good about it, and it'll sure help. We stand the tallest when we stoop to help others. That's what they like to say. It's a wonderful, wonderful thought, wonderful sentiment. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. And remember, all of the proceeds from the operation of their thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8 South, all the revenue stays right here in Butler County to help the less fortunate. Listeners, coming up on the next segment of the It's Your Turn program today, and I've been telling you for a few days now that we were going to be able to chat a little bit about one of the great mysteries of Pittsburgh, and that's the disappearance of a World War II-era bomber into the Mon River. It crashed into the Mon, and it's never been found. And this was just over 60 years ago. We have an opportunity to chat for a few minutes with a guest who joins us here in the studio. His name is Paul Zwitek. Am I pronouncing that last name correctly, Paul?
Yeah, it's close enough.
Paul. Now, Paul wasn't there, but he once worked on tugboats on the Monongahela River, and he's talked with people during his time there. And you can imagine, if you worked on a tug on the Mon, this would be a subject that would come up on many occasions, I think. This is one of the greatest mysteries in Pittsburgh history, Paul.
Yeah, it comes up quite often. Well, like I told you before, it's all scuttlebutt. Mm-hmm. But I worked with a tugboat captain that was on the Expediter, and he's picked up three members of the crew.
Yes, right. Some of the crew members were rescued after. Yeah. Let me set the stage here. I'm sure most of our listeners have at least heard about this story, but it would probably be good if we gave some of the pertinent facts here before we start talking. This happened, actually, it was about this time of the year. It was January 31st, 1956. So it was right about this time of year, 61 years ago. The pilot of this World War II era bomber, obviously this was after World War II. It was 1956. But this was a B-25, two-engine. This was not a Piper Cub that disappeared into the Mall. This was a big plane. It was a World War II bomber. As I understand it, it was being flown from somewhere out west to Harrisburg. Now, I did a little bit of background work from the Heinz History Center down in Pittsburgh, where they've been investigating this, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But the crew, Major William Dotson, the pilot, and five crew and passengers, where it was supposedly a routine flight from an Air Force base in Nevada to pick up a cargo of airplane parts at Olmsted Air Force Base in Harrisburg. They had stopped twice for refueling, once in Oklahoma, once in Michigan. They were flying over Pittsburgh when Major Dotson reported that he was losing fuel, and he was seeking permission to land at what was then Greater Pittsburgh Airport. Radioed back in a few minutes later, realized he wasn't going to make there, requested permission to try to land at the Allegheny County Airport, and then realized he wasn't even going to make it there, so he decided he was going to have to pull a what we now know as a Sully Sullenberger, who landed a U.S. Airways plane on the Hudson a few years ago. He was going to try to put it down, wheels up, on the Monongahela River, and try to save everybody, which in fact he did. And by the way, when I first heard about this, I assumed it was at night, since they were never able to find the plane. It was late afternoon. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
Even in late January, there's plenty of daylight at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, it's almost 6 o'clock now before the sun goes down. So this did happen in broad daylight. Now, you know, a tragedy. Some of the crew were rescued. Some were not. Two of them died. But the real mystery about this is they never found the plane. It's a bomber, for goodness sakes, in the Mall, and they never found it. So there are all kind of theories about this. There have been investigations, yada, yada. When I heard from a mutual friend, Jack Pavlik, thank you, Jack, and when I heard about Paul and when he had worked on the Mall and he had heard some of the rumors, some of the scuttlebutt, I said, well, let's talk about this, for goodness sakes, because I've always been fascinated by this story. Okay. Now, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but just to set the stage for people, you had the opportunity when you were working on the tugs on the Mall to talk with a gentleman who was there when it happened, right?
Yes, he in fact seen the aircraft crash.
Wow.
And when he seen that, he immediately got rid of the tow that he had, mm-hmm. and went up with the expediter and started picking up survivors. He picked up three survivors. He took them to the opposite side of the river where they met an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them went in the ambulance, and they went downriver. The third survivor, just don't know why, went into another vehicle, and they went up the river.
Hmm.
And he could never figure out why they did that, because the closest hospital was downriver from there.
Well, who knows? It could be that, for example, today, Allegheny General and UPMC in Oakland are the two big trauma centers in Pittsburgh, a lot of other hospitals. And depending on your situation, if you've got to get to a hospital as quickly as you can, you go to the closest one. If you have some kind of specialty mm-hmm. injuries, they might have been taking them somewhere else. I don't know. I just wanted to, let me check my notes here, Paul, from the Heinz History Center, which had a big exhibit on this a year ago, because a year ago was the 60th anniversary last year. All six members of the crew survived the actual crash, but only four of them were rescued. Two others drowned trying to swim to shore. So the guy that you talked to had actually picked up three of the four that survived.
Okay, well... Hmm. The yeah. part that he was telling me, they only picked up two is what the report was.
Uh-huh.
And so he knows he picked up three men.
Wow. And that still leaves another one that's unaccounted for somewhere.
You know, somebody's unaccounted for.
Mm-hmm. I also read in the Heinz History Center story that there was a Coast Guard boat and there is Coast Guard and River Patrol around Pittsburgh that went speeding to the scene and supposedly snagged a wing with its anchor, but it broke off. The anchor broke free, and so they never got anything. And to this day, 61 years later, that bomber, the whole plane, remains missing. Did the guy that you talked to, the guy that actually saw the crash, can you imagine that? If you're on a tugboat on the Mon and you look up and there's a bomber crashing into the Mon, what an incredible thing. So he cut loose of his tugs and went steaming up toward. Did he have any thoughts on, did he talk about seeing a piece of the plane or some of the wreckage or anything like that, or just picking up the survivors?
He's seen the tail end go down.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the plane had already went down. He told me he's seen the tail end go down. And, well, the Corps of Engineers came up to see if they could find it. They brought their A-frame up and called the Manello. And they tried to find it, couldn't find it. They were dragging, supposedly hooked something down there.
Mm-hmm. This happened, by the way, near the what we call today, well, the bridge, the name of the bridge has changed. It's the Homestead-Graves Bridge.
Yeah.
I think before, I know when I was in high school, it was the Homestead High Level Bridge. That's what they called it then. It's now named after the Negro League baseball team, the Homestead-Graves. So if you're familiar with Pittsburgh, that's where it is. This is not down at the point, but it's not all that far away either, upstream up the Mon. So
it's about mile 8.
Thank you. I should have known that you would know that. Working on, by the way, how long did you work on a tug on the Mon?
On the Mon, I was on the Mon River for about 3-4 years.
And you worked on tugs elsewhere in the United States, right?
And Lower Mississippi.
Wow.
The ship that I, the tug that I was on in Lower Mississippi was 10,500 horsepower.
My goodness.
Motor vessel Jason. We had 60 barges in tow.
And many times fully loaded with coal and other stuff, huh?
Just about everything.
Can't imagine how much horsepower that would take to move 60 barges. And, of course, you could move them upstream, too, couldn't you?
Yeah, against an 8-mile-an-hour current.
Wow. One powerful boat. Yeah, all those tugs are powerful. So this guy that you talked to, he saw the tail going down. I've also been intrigued, and I just found out this this out today when I was reading the Heinz History Center website. I didn't know how deep the Mon was. That would be a good question. When a plane goes down, it's 20 feet deep there, which is not all that deep when you're talking about a bomber going down there.
Especially since the bomber was 16 feet tall.
Yeah, so the tail section, which would be the highest part of the plane, wouldn't be that far below the surface of the water when it went in.
I worked for the Corps of Engineers. They said that the stories I got there, the tail section was taken down to Neville Island.
Mm.
The tail of the plane, it had broken off.
Mm-hmm.
But they could never. They claimed they could never find the plane down there.
Now there are rumors. There have been ever since. Obviously, I mean, what an incident for conspiracy theories. A bomber disappears in the Mon. There are some people who say that the military rushed in later that night, and they got most of the plane and secreted it away because of, and these are more conspiracy theories, what may have been on it. Any of the guys that you talked to that worked on the Mon, did they talk about that or refute that or anything?
Oh, some of them talked about it. Talked about a covered barge going downriver from the crash site. Another pilot that I worked with, he claims that there was an armed guard on the banks, wouldn't let anybody down there.
Hmm. By the way, folks, this really happened. I want to make sure, because some people, I'm sure, say, this is urban legend. The Heinz History Center has on their website a picture of the front page of the Post Gazette the following day, Wednesday, February 1st. B-25 crashes in river here. Two missing, and of course those two individuals ended up drowned. They did find their bodies, but it wasn't until a couple of weeks later, I think, that they found the bodies of those two. How many were rescued remains in question. And that's just one of those things, isn't it, Paul? One of those things that doesn't add up. And you say, when you get three or four of those things that don't add up, then you start thinking, you know. There are people who suggest that there may have been a secret weapon on that plane that was being shuttled back to the Air Force Base in Harrisburg.
Well,
I certainly don't know.
I don't know either, but when I was growing up, I heard it. Well, let's see, I guess that was in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching a documentary on television, and it was about this particular aircraft. And there was a couple of aeronautic engineers figured out, well, how much does the aircraft weigh, how much fuel did they have aboard, and why would they run out of fuel at that particular point? And so they figured that there had to be something aboard her that really wasn't supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be an empty aircraft.
Something that weighed a lot.
Yeah,
on
like,
there.
Well, they claimed that it might have been two nuclear devices or two atomic bombs.
I've heard that conspiracy theory as well, especially when you consider, I mean, this wasn't a long-range plane, but it was a World War II bomber. It had already refueled twice. It refueled in Oklahoma after taking off from Nevada. It refueled in Michigan, which is not all that far by plane from Pittsburgh.
Right.
So how did it run out of fuel so quickly? Another unanswered question.
Yeah. Well, it's not a long-range bomber, as you said. But I know that these engineers figured out how much weight was on there, and they came up with the theory of it being nuclear devices.
The strangest conspiracy theory that I've heard, I don't know whether you've ever heard this one, Paul, was that, you know, there supposedly is a river that runs underneath the point, an underground river that is used to help feed the fountain at the point, an underground river. I read about a conspiracy theory of people that think this plane actually went down so far into the Mon that it went into this underground river, and that's where it is. Now, that's one of those ones where I just shake my head. I think there are conspiracy theories, and then there are wacko conspiracy theories. You know?
I don't think that's even possible. The dams are built to maintain a pool level, so barge traffic can move up and down a river.
That's interesting. I never knew that.
They call it pools. Between each dam is a pool. Now, those dams just maintain that level so they have at least 9 feet of water, because that's what a barge drafts, 9 feet.
Okay.
A loaded barge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most towboats don't draft that deep.
And if you didn't have that, you can look anywhere along the Allegheny, which we're more familiar with. Once you get above the last dam, which is below East Brady, I think, on the Allegheny, it's not navigable anymore. It's too shallow.
Because, right there at Brady's Bend.
There's no pool. Yeah, that's the last pool above that dam.
Des Moines, you can go 132 miles. But when you get up above the mile 66,
mm-hmm.
Right around in that area, the water starts getting clearer and clearer. And when you get to the 132-mile dam, there's an actual dam and lock up there. The water's crystal clear. You can see all the way to the bottom.
Wow.
To the loaded barges.
Huh. Everybody thinks of the Mon, I do, is a very dirty and muddy river.
Well, the Monongahela means River of Falling Banks. That's an Indian name for River of Falling Banks.
We're chatting for listeners who may be joining us a little bit later, wondering what we're talking about here on It's Your Turn Today. Our guest with us here in the studio is Paul Zwietek. He was a Navy veteran. In fact, I want to talk with Paul a little bit about his military service here later. But for the purposes of our initial discussion here, We're talking about one of the great mysteries of Pittsburgh. Some people think it's the greatest mystery of Pittsburgh, the disappearance of the ghost bomber, a B-25 that crash-landed in the Monongahela River almost exactly 61 years ago, January 31st, 1956. Crashed, disappeared, and has never been seen since. And, you know, people have wondered for decades now, how the heck can a bomber disappear in the waters of the Mon? Some have suggested that the current just took it all the way downstream, down past the point and down into the Ohio. Wouldn't it get caught up on dams further downstream if that, that happened?
Where it went in, the next dam down would be, at that time, I believe old Lock 1 was still in operation.
It would be down past the West End Bridge, right? Well down from the point?
It would be Emsworth.
Okay, Emsworth. Yeah, I know that name. Yeah.
But the Mon River is so muddy and silty at the bottom. I can understand it sinking and stopping.
Mm-hmm.
That silt's like a suction cup.
Yeah. And it's thousands of years that silt has
been building up.
You know how it is, listeners, if you've ever stepped into a creek or a pond or a river, usually you go in ankle deep, at least, you know, because of the silt. A bomber, okay, I can buy that. Maybe it did disappear into the mucky bottom. Now, a few years ago, the Hines History Center was involved in an effort with some local individuals to bring in side scan sonar and all kind of new technology that's developed that they didn't have 60 years ago, and search this area. Search quite a ways around this area to try to find it. A lot of publicity about that in the Pittsburgh newspapers, Pittsburgh TV. They spent weeks trying to do it, found nothing. Nothing. Using the latest imagery and side scan sonar and everything else.
Side scan sonar is great. If you have a sunken barge down there, you can see the timber heads on the barge.
Wow.
It's almost like a picture.
Mm-hmm. That makes you wonder. Of course, unless it had either settled a great deal, but the plane is 16 feet high, or it did drift at least downstream somewhere. I'm assuming that there are pockets, maybe like mini pools here and there, depending on the surface at the bottom of the Mon, where maybe it could have sunk into a little hole.
It's not the same depth all the way, but the way the current goes, it could have taken it into a little cove or something on the side.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't see it disappearing.
Yeah. One of the other conspiracy theories that I saw, and this is on one of, I don't know, who knows how crazy they are. There have been everything from secret cargo on the plane, as you mentioned, perhaps an atomic bomb or two, some other weapon. I saw one story that suggested there were a bunch of call girls that were being transferred to Washington, D.C. For U.S. senators. Now, that is what I call really way out there. But
it may be way out there, but it might be true.
Well, this is what, when people don't have any answers, don't have anything that makes sense, this is what they come up with. You know, what could it be? You just can't imagine that they didn't find this thing. I saw one story on the Hines History Center website that said some people have suggested that because of the high corrosive content of the water in the Mon, that the aluminum parts of the plane, mainly the fuselage and most of it, would have been corroded away over the years. But that would still leave a couple of big engines and the entire landing gear. That's not aluminum. That's all steel.
Rubber still be there too for the tires.
I didn't think about that. The rubber, yeah. Not a sound, not a trace, not a hint of where it is. I assume that they've somebody, the Army or the Air Force or somebody, interviewed the survivors. I don't know whether that's public information or not. I've never seen anything about that. The story has been written up by Thomas White, who's a professor at Duquesne University. Actually, we've had Tom on the program here two or three times. He's written some interesting books about the forgotten lore of Pittsburgh and so on. This story is the cover story on his book entitled Legends and Lore of Western Pennsylvania. In fact, there's a pretty astonishing painting of depicting this bomber going into the Mon on the cover of Thomas White's book. So it's been investigated by a lot of people. Private individuals have spent a lot of money on it. This thing with the History Center two or three years ago in that summer, I spent a lot of money on that with the side-scan sonar and everything. Didn't find anything. Did you have any of the folks that you talked to? Now, again, folks, this is Scuttlebutt. Paul was not there. But you talked with people who were there when this happened. Did they have any ideas on what might have happened to it? Anything that we haven't mentioned?
Well, just about every one of them that I've talked to said that the Corps of Engineers had picked that plane up.
Mm-hmm. And that's the covered barge that was seen going down river.
That would be the covered barge going down the river.
Yeah.
And they most of these pilots believe, including some of the deckhands, you know, that work the boats, really believe that that's what happened.
Hmm.
The Corps of Engineers, being a military, wouldn't tell you anyways.
Yeah. I got to give you one more conspiracy theory before we take a quick break, because I want to talk with Paul for a couple of minutes about his military service. I even read one story where these individuals think that they were carrying something or someone from Area 51 out in, this is New Mexico, isn't it? Is that where Area 51 is, where they think the aliens have landed and so on and so on and so forth? I suppose that conspiracy theory comes from the fact that this bomber took off from Nevada, which would not be all that far from Area 51. Who knows, huh?
Well, there's rumors that some stuff from Area 51 is in Columbus, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yeah, I've heard that, too. They have a special hangar there that nobody goes in. Well, listen, I'm going to talk to Paul for a couple of more minutes, so we'll take a quick break. I want to talk about his military service, because you're a pretty rare veteran. You served in both Vietnam and the Persian Gulf, right?
Desert Storm.
Desert Storm. Wow. Talk for a few minutes about that with our guest, Paul Zwietek. Here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
If you're thinking about buying a car, truck, or SUV, or even if you just bought one, make sure you check out the great rates at Butler Armco Employees Credit Union. Through February 28th, you can get a 36-month loan on new and used vehicles for as low as 0.99% annual percentage rate. We'll even refinance your loan from another financial institution. It's never been easier to join, so call today or visit us at baecu.com for membership and rate information. Butler Armco Employees Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Is 100 a lot? 100 pennies are not. 100 people are not. What about 100 years in business? Yep, that's a lot. GE, Coca-Cola, Wells Fargo, companies we know well and have depended on for over 100 years. I'm proud to say Butler County Ford joins the ranks. To celebrate, we kick off our century of service with 100 great deals, surprises, contests, giveaways, and much more. Butler County Ford, downtown Butler, get ready to celebrate.
Hey, mate, be sure to keep tuned here on WISR through the coming year, because we will be bringing you all of the details of the special events, the special promotions, the special deals that will be going on throughout this year as Butler County Ford prepares to mark its 100th anniversary, 100 years, and 100 years at the same location. Yes, Main and Wayne, downtown Butler, your Ford corner. 100 years, how about that? Butler County Ford, your hometown, downtown dealer, where you'll find straightforward deals, get top dollar on your trade, and get exemplary service after the sale. Check them out online, butlercountyford.com. Their entire inventory of vehicles is online, by the way. Every single car, truck, SUV, new and used. They're all listed there. You can browse the whole list on the web at butlercountyford.com. Butler County Ford, Main and Wayne, downtown Butler, your Ford corner, online at butlercountyford.com. We'll be getting back to our guest talking about the mystery of the bomber in the Mon in just a moment.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard. So you don't need to mooch off your friends.
You gonna finish that grape?
You mean the one in my mouth?
You don't need to stop buying the necessities.
What you're smelling is a natural musk.
Ew.
You don't need to be a medical test subject.
How do you feel?
Mostly okay. I... Sometimes, though.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman.
We need a new stuntman! Let's break for lunch.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on FeedThePig.org. That way, you don't need to sell your soul to the devil.
$15 is the best I can do.
All right, deal.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, folks. If you're just joining us, we're very happy to be able to talk with a local man, Paul Zawitek. He's from the northern part of our listening area, up around Parker. He had a career on tugboats, both on the Monongahela River, which is why we wanted to chat with him about the missing bomber. Also worked on tugboats on the Mississippi, lower Mississippi, you said?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's where the current would be strongest. That's where it's the biggest, most powerful. Yeah. But you were also, you served also in Vietnam and in the Middle East. First of all, let's talk about the Pershing Gulf. What branch of the service were you in, Paul?
I was in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I retired as a chief boatswain mate.
Oh, really? So you were on, were you on the same ship the whole time?
Oh, no. Excuse me. The first ship I was on was the Blandy. And we did a May cruise, and we did one down to Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mostly to get down Guantanamo. It was in preparation for going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a year in Vietnam.
Did you go through the Panama Canal to get over there?
Through the Panama Canal, mm-hmm. both ways, going and coming.
What kind of a ship was this?
Destroyer.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Had 3 5-inch guns and 1 twin-mount 3-inch .50.
So you were there for a year off the coast of Vietnam?
Just about a whole year, yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. We did mostly harassment and interdiction, and we were called in for gunfire and support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there was an operation, a land operation going on, you would be supporting with your guns from out at sea?
From out at sea.
Mm-hmm.
We were running what they called the slack track. We were just running real close. And you'd go two knots for so far, turn around, come back, go 2 knots back until you get a support mission or an H&I mission.
Then two knots is pretty slow, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You'd just be creeping along.
About 3 mile an hour.
Yeah.
We took on fire a couple of times.
I was going to say, if you're going that slow, you're kind of a sitting duck, aren't you?
Yeah, really are, yeah.
Yeah.
We were right below an island off of, right at the DMZ. Cape Lay was the DMZ.
DMZ stands for the Demilitarized Zone, and it was the dividing line between South Vietnam and North Vietnam.
Correct.
About halfway up the country. Yeah.
And there's this little island that was off of it, and the Vietnamese were trying to, North Vietnamese were trying to put a rocket launcher platform out there. We caught them doing it. They mm-hmm. they sent it out. And we called them bum boats, mm-hmm. just a little fishing boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd row out to the island with parts, and they would start to build these launching platforms. So we'd report them, and they'd send in the Seabees, or not the Seabees, but the Navy SEALs, and the SEALs would take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Did that three or four times while I was there. And then the battleship New Jersey was there at the same time. We were told to get out of the way. The island no longer exists.
New Jersey blew it away.
All it is a sandbar.
Wow. Wow. a little bit about the relative size of the ships. Battleship is that's the next biggest to an aircraft carrier, right? I mean, that's a monster with huge guns.
16-inch guns.
Is the next step down in size, is that a destroyer?
No, it would be cruisers.
Cruiser and then destroyer. How many?
Cruisers, light cruisers, destroyers. There's very few destroyers left. Most of them now are fast attack type ships. They're DEs, destroyer escorts, which was smaller than a destroyer.
What was the main purpose of a destroyer? They were faster than cruisers and battleships?
They're faster. They were mainly for H&I gunfire missions, that type of thing, and anti-submarine warfare.
Oh, okay. Anti-submarine warfare? You mean like with depth charges?
Depth charges, torpedoes. The Blandy had six smaller torpedoes and two kind of large ones.
Did you ever have to fire any of those whenever you were on board?
The only time we fired them is when we were doing drills for submarine warfare.
The stuff we see in the movies about depth charges coming off the back of a destroyer to try to blow up a submarine, is that legit, or is that movie maker license?
That's legit. They also have a thing called hedgehogs. These hedgehogs are probably about 3 feet long, and when they fire them off, a group of them goes up into the air and circles the submarine and explodes and caves in the submarine from the percussion of the. Since that percussion is amplified in the water.
So you came back from your tour in Vietnam, back to. Stateside, you were still in the Navy?
Yes.
And then how did you, because it's quite a ways from the end of the Vietnam War to Desert Storm. There's quite a few years in between there.
Okay, here's what happened. We decommissioned the Blandy.
Okay.
She came back out about a year later. I was on another ship at that time, the USS Massey. We did a med cruise and a North Atlantic cruise on the Massey. And that was about, since Vietnam, a lot of us didn't want to stay in for very long.
Yeah, it's understandable,
So I got out. Started raising my kids. Got three kids, two at that time. Building a house, but trying to buy a house. We needed some extra money, so I went in on the reserve side.
I see.
And did a couple different units on the reserves, and then being a bosun mate, they needed somebody to help put a unit together for cargo handling. There was 12 reserve cargo handling units. There's only one active duty unit. And what we would do is any aspect of moving cargo, we did it. We moved it. We loaded more Army ships than we did Navy ships.
I was going to say, you were in the Navy, and most of the action in Desert Storm was Army on land.
Army ships are mostly supply ships. There's no... There are very few armament on the Army ships. The Navy tags along.
Where did they load up? Along the East Coast?
Everywhere. East Coast, West Coast. I've been to Hawaii 5 times. I spent over 15 years in that particular unit, the cargo unit. It was Cargo Battalion 9. We had a little bit of competition with some of the Army cargo handlers, and it takes 350 people for Army to load a ship. The Navy can do it with 150 and faster.
Take that, Army guys, huh?
Reason being, though, is the Navy is cross-trained for just about everything. If somebody would take out a hatch captain, let's say, as someone who's running a hatch, somebody else just step right into that place.
Okay.
And it goes right on down through the whole ranks. Everybody is trained to do just about everybody's job.
And you were a bosun's mate, is that right?
Bosun's mate, right.
And what were the responsibilities of that particular job?
Well, aboard ship, they do just about everything. They pilot the ship.
Oh.
They maintain the ship. They bring stores aboard, fuel. They're the ones that do all that rigging.
So you were able to pilot the ship if you had to, huh?
Oh, we have. There's a crew up there in the pilot house.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to learn gunnery.
Mm-hmm.
I was gun captain for Mount 51, which is a 5-inch 54 on the Blandy.
Were you based anywhere when you were doing all this cargo work? Were you based somewhere in the U.S., or did you move around?
Well, our headquarters was in Columbus.
Ohio?
It was DCAC at the time.
I see.
But it's right next to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm.
Previously mentioned in our discussion here.
I've seen that
hangar.
That hangar, yeah.
So you came out, and then did you start working on tugs after you came out of the reserves?
It was before I came out of reserves.
It was before, okay.
Before I even went into the reserves. I was out for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, it's quite a span there between the end of the war in Southeast Asia, which was 1973, as I recall, and Desert Storm, which was
91,
early 1990s. Well, let me speak for all of our listeners. First of all, Paul, when I say thank you for your service, I'm not sure that I ever talked with anyone before who had served in both Southeast Asia and Desert Storm. So thank you for your service.
You're very welcome.
Yeah.
I was happy to do it.
Never regret going into the Navy?
No.
Spoken like a true Navy guy.
The wife didn't want me to go back in again.
Mm-hmm.
She, in fact, I hit higher tenure is why I retired.
Paul is wearing a hat that says U.S. Navy CPO retired, and wearing it proudly, I would say. Yeah. Gosh, Paul, I know you're a busy guy. I want to thank you for stopping in and chatting with us today. A little bit about your military service. And certainly as we said earlier, this is scuttlebutt, it's legend, but it cuts pretty close to the bone whenever you talk with somebody who actually witnessed this plane going down and who was working on a tug on the Mon just as Paul did. So that's about as close to firsthand knowledge as I've had a chance to chat with. Appreciate you coming in today. Appreciate it.
I was happy to talk with you.
Are you originally from this area, or did you move here?
I was born in the South Side.
Oh, okay. Of Butler?
No.
Oh, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Okay. We have a South Side in Butler, too.
Yeah, I know.
So you eventually moved up then up toward the Parker area.
I started work with the Corps of Engineers. I moved out away from Pittsburgh. We lived in Pittsburgh for a good while. Mount Washington, to be exact.
Mm-hmm.
Moved up to DeVosburg, because it was halfway between where my wife worked and I worked.
Where you worked, yeah.
She had a lot of traffic. I didn't. It took me 15 minutes to get to work. It took her half an hour.
Well, and I hope to see this pretty soon, because we've waited a long time for repair work and reconstruction work on the locks on our rivers here in western Pennsylvania. And I understand that the federal government is finally approving some money for that. I don't know if it's been released yet. I don't know what we're going to see, but you, more than anyone, will be able to say how badly needed that work is, huh?
It is definitely badly needed, especially the older locks. The the lock I was on, lock 3 in Elizabeth, PA, it was built in 1909.
Oh my gosh.
It's still in operation. There's been rehabs done over the years, but they were supposed to take that lock out altogether back in 2000. They did the work on lock 2. The big thing with they brought parts of the dam up on barges and floated them. And in fact, they floated parts of the concrete parts of the dam too, and then and sunk them in place.
Wow. Without the locks, of course, the rivers, the Allegheny and the Mon would be, they would not be navigable with tugs and cargo. In fact, in some areas, not even navigable for pleasure craft, so they're crucial. Well, I got to let you get along with your business here. Paul Zwitek, thanks again for stopping and chatting with us. I really enjoyed talking to you. I really did.
Thank you. I enjoyed the same, too.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 5454. The pick 3 is 572, 572. The pick 4, 3647. The pick 5, 39053. The wild ball for each of those is 0. The treasure hunt today, 5, 8, 9, 28, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000. Lottery numbers brought to you by New Haven Court at Clearview.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Whether you're a backyard car fixer-upper or an auto repair shop, Milich Auto Wrecking is still the place to go for new and used auto and truck parts. Have been for the past 40 years. And compared to factory prices, will save you big bucks. Milich Auto Wrecking is neatly organized and will tell you immediately if they have the part or not. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. It's Milich Auto Wrecking, Route 38, the United Valley Road. Look for the big black and red sign. Stop by or call 287-1001. Yes, old Uncle Fred still goes to Milich.
Dating back to the administration of Robert P. Casey, Radio PA's Ask the Governor program has connected you with your Commonwealth's governor. Governor Tom Wolf is the latest chief executive to answer your questions on Radio PA, as each month he joins us in studio to address the major issues affecting you, your family, and your community. In this era of political bickering and infighting, Radio PA's Ask the Governor is still a place for a lively but civil discussion of hot-button issues.
In any society, there are people who just want to yell at each other, but the folks who get things done are the folks who sit down and say, okay, we disagree. Let's figure out, you know, how we can actually work together.
You can be a part of our next program with Governor Tom Wolf by visiting pamatters.com and clicking on the Ask the Governor link at the top of the page. You can also email a question directly to askthegov@pamatters.com. That's askthegov, G-O-V, at pamatters.com. Send your question or comment today and be part of our next edition of Ask the Governor.
Thank our guests today. Very informative program, fun show. Certainly learned a little bit about local history with Rodney Gash visiting with us. Rodney is the president of Historic Harmony. He had all of the details on the upcoming George Washington hike a week from Saturday up at Jennings. A hike with reenactors, local history guide, cherry pie, coffee, the whole works. So nice stuff. And, of course, with Paul Zwitek, who we just talked with, about the bomber in the Mon. What a fascinating story and what a mysterious story. Coming up tomorrow, we begin talking about the opioid crisis. We have several guests scheduled in over the next couple of days to talk about this. There's another opioid forum coming up next week at Slippery Rock High School. And we're going to be talking with, among other guests, Bob Muntz, who's the coordinator of the Drug and Alcohol Services at Butler Health Services. Also, he's a family intervention specialist. I'll be talking with him about ways to assist an addict in getting help without enabling that person. We're also scheduled to chat with Detective Mark Pfeffer from law enforcement about the upcoming summit. We will be talking with a recovering addict as well. Jason Beckwith will be with us on Friday. So we'll cover this, try to cover this from several different angles over the next couple of days. That's it for the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. I'm Dave Malarkey. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. We'll see you tomorrow here on It's Your Turn on WI.